Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 28, Comic-Con Special, Part 1.
Prepare for takeoff. Guiding you down publishing's dark alleyways.
Rubbing it in, like salt in a wound.
Expounding on the greatness of science fiction and fantasy.
A science fiction writer should try to combine the intimately human with the grandly cosmic.
Hi, this is Tobias Bakel, author of Crystal Rain.
And taking themselves way too seriously.
I've had many, many a giggle over it.
Very dramatic. Very nice.
That sounded really realistic, didn't it?
From the Singularity Audio Studios in San Diego, California, your hosts, Sean and Sam.
Then that's where you cue the cheering.
All right, we're going back to press. We're going back to press. Well, hey there, publishing fans. Welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. My name is Sean Farrell, and I'm going alone again this week. But that's all right, because I'm going to keep this very brief. Got a lot of good stuff for you, and I want to get right to it. But first, let me tell you what you're going to get in this part one of the Comic-Con special report, and then what you're going to get in the coming weeks. Today, I have interviews with R.A. Salvatore and Brett Close of 38 Studios, a new gaming company founded by Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling. Of course, all of you should recognize who R.A. Salvatore is, the creator of Dritz d'Ordin, and also did some Star Wars novelizations and The Highwayman and a bunch of other really great books. And Brett is the CEO of 38 Studios. So they're going to tell us a little bit about what's going on with this new gaming company and their plans over the next couple of years. And you can bet that books are going to be among their marketing plans. Well, they didn't actually come out and say that, but Bob's working with them, and you'll see what I mean when you hear the interviews. Then you'll get an interview with Jeremy Lassen, editor-in-chief of Nightshade Books. He's going to talk about Nightshade's history a bit and the differences between small press and big press. So thanks again, Bob, Brett, and Jeremy, for making time to talk with me at the con. It was absolutely crazy there, so I really appreciate that you did that. Next week, I will release part two of the Comic-Con report, and that features my interviews with Stargate Atlantis cast and crew. I was surprised but very pleased to have the opportunity to conduct one-on-one interviews with Joe Flanagan, David Hewlett, and Jewel State of Firefly fame, and executive producer Joseph Malazzi. I'm doing some special editing with these interviews, so I need a little bit more time to get them ready, but they're going to be a blast. So, sci-fi fans, Stargate fans, spread the word. We have exclusive Stargate interviews right here on Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Also next week, Sam and I will reminisce a little bit about the con that was, so all of you who couldn't be there, you'll get your fill. Then in 2 weeks, you're going to get an interview with New York Times bestselling author Jacqueline Carey. As you can see, we have a lot of great stuff going on around here, but I'm going to stop gabbing and get right to the interviews. Please send us your feedback and your questions to adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com or give us a call. Leave us a voicemail at 206-350-5029. We'll get you on the show that way. Tobias Bakel is recording another segment for us, so remember to send in your questions for the Ask a Writer segment. And the From the Editor's Desk segment will pick up again soon. So if you have questions that you want to ask a professional editor, please send those in as well. All right, thank you everyone for listening. I'm going to get out of here, and I'll see you next week.
Curious about the future? Do you wonder what we can expect of next week, next year, next century? What we will eat, drive, wear, live in, vote for, want to buy, and want to avoid? What mistakes of the past we will make again, and which ones we have learned from? The Future in You is an award-winning podcast which explores the future. Composed of interviews and essays, it's now teamed with the science fiction and fantasy online magazine Jim Bain's Universe. Recent guests include best-selling authors like Greg Bear, Kim Stanley Robinson, Alan Dean Foster, Mike Resnick, Spider Robinson, David Brin, Joe Haldeman, Werner Vinge, and many, many more. Less famous guests have included a cryonics insurance agent, a battle robot builder, various transhumanists, and scientists. Topics have included nanotechnology and molecular manufacturing, hackers and hacking, computers wired directly into the human brain, genetic engineering, cloning and stem cell research, cryonics, global climate change, exoplanets and faster-than-light travel, robots, the singularity and artificial intelligence, transhumanism, and medical longevity. From the next tick of the clock to the ultimate end of the universe, every subject is fair game. To learn more, check the show's website at thefutureandyou.com.
All right, I'm joined by Bob Salvador, 38 Studios. How you doing, Bob?
Great. It's good to see you again, Sean.
You too. Last time we talked, you gave us a little bit of information about what was then Green Monster Games. So what can you tell us now about 38 Studios?
I still wear my Green Monster Games t-shirt.
Okay.
No, all right.
And that was Comic-Con. Give us some insider stuff. Yeah.
There's really not a lot of insider stuff to give you. What I can tell you is what's been really cool is we've put the team together. For obviously a game project like this. I mean, what I found hilarious was when the announcement first went out, all over message boards, they would say, McFarlane, Salvatore, and Schilling, what do they know about making a computer game? Well, duh. I can't program my phone. So that's not me. So we went out and we got some amazing talent from a lot of different game companies, EA, Sony, Midway. I mean, people have been in the industry for a lot of years. And we put together a team, and Kurt really handpicked everybody. And, taking recommendations from other people. So we got together a team of people who work together well. And amazingly talented and creative group of people. And now my job has kind of morphed. My job originally was kind of form the background for this story in the world. Well, that doesn't take years to do. But what now has to happen is all that background I gave them, all the threads have to be longer. We have to come up with all the details of the world. So my job's almost morphed into becoming an editor, just making all these incredible content, mechanic, designers, and artists stay on the same page so we're all painting on the same tapestry. Because what I really am looking for is a consistency in the world that makes sense to the player. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah.
So here I'm working with these incredibly talented, up-and-coming, and very well-established at the same time designers and artists. And it's amazing to me because usually when I work on an artist, I write a book, and then I have to give the artist some suggestions. And if I'm lucky, I get a Todd Lockwood or a Keith Parkinson or a Larry Elmore, and they get it, and they come up with something, and I look at it, and I go, wow, that's just great. Now I see that every day. So when we're talking to one of the artists, I come in the next day. I come in 2 days a week. I come in the next day, and there's the artist, and he's showing me the stuff from what we were talking about with the content team the week before. Well, is this kind of what you were talking about? I'm like, oh, man, this is just great. So it's an incredible experience.
So you get to see your work come to life as you're in process so than you would in the novel.
Yeah, in the concept. That wasn't me.
That's ambient noise there.
Sorry, Mexican food. No, in the concept. I mean, obviously, we're still in concept form. So day to day, it's incredible.
So what has it been like to work with Todd?
I haven't seen him as much as I'd like to yet because really the content starts it all. And then it goes out to the art. So he's teleconferencing with the art guys, and they're trying to come up with their style that's going to permeate everything. But working with him, and I have seen him, and I can't wait to see him out here. I think he's coming in tomorrow. It's been just fabulous. Todd's one of those people you meet, and almost like 5 minutes into the conversation, that he's not seeing the same things you're seeing. I'm looking at a train out there right now. Todd's looking at that, and he's seeing all kinds of shapes that I'm not seeing. He truly looks at the world in a different way. And I've only met one other person that I can say that about, and that would be George Lucas.
Well, that's high praise right there.
Well, and I think it's true of a lot of artists. They just see the world differently from everybody else.
Now, doing the research I was doing on the website, it looks like you guys are really dedicated to doing lots of different things. Besides, you got the video game, obviously. But what else can we expect from you guys over the next couple of years?
One of the reasons we changed our name to 38 Studios is because we're not a game company. We're an IP company. The game will be, of course, the showcase of the IP, but we're talking about an intellectual property here, and we're talking about entertainment. We're an entertainment company, and that's going to mean, look, I write books. I write short stories. I can write screenplays or comic books. Todd does comic books. Todd does toys. We have people that have come from all different gaming formats. And we're trying to create immersive experiences that we don't want it to be just come play our game. And then, 2 years after we launch the game, it's really good. And we go, geez, we should do graphic novels or something. We don't want any of that to be an afterthought. Everything we're doing all the things we're thinking, what's good, what are good directions to go in? We're trying to put in at zero. We're at zero. We're at zero plus like 4 out of 100 right now. And this is where we're trying to get all those threads together so that as we get to launch, you know, at 100, the things that we think will help that immersive experience will already be in place, whether it's a novel line or a graphic novel line or a toy line or whatever.
Now, when you say in place, do you mean in production, or are you going to have all these things come out simultaneously?
Well, I think a little of both. I mean, it's obvious you don't, like, flood the market with something, but that's up to the marketing people to decide how we do things like that. But one of the things I talked about, if we talk about the possibility, like, I edited the Sony, EverQuest book line, and I love the world of EverQuest. I have nothing bad to say about it at all. But the problems we had is the book line was coming in so after the fact that it was, I don't want to say it was an afterthought, but there was nobody there to make it an integral part of anything either.
Did it sort of miss that moment where EverQuest was at its peak?
I think that's true. And that wasn't for lack of trying. The first time I played EverQuest, I called several New York publishers and said, you should do a book line on this yesterday. Because you really have to hit the peak. You have to, you know, you don't want people to just see what they've already done. You want them to see the possibility for what's coming too. But the problem with that is, the book line, because it was so after the fact, and there was really a maintenance team on EverQuest by that time instead of a full-blown development team, the book line was almost never connected correctly to the game. And I don't just mean that in terms of themes, because the books were pretty good. I don't mean that in terms of themes. I mean in terms of just having a marketing and introduce it to the player population concept so that everybody playing that game knows, hey, look, we got these cool books that go with it. If you're going to do something like that, you do it at the beginning, and that's the difference. That's a big difference between us and anything that's come before, because it's such a young company. I mean, an industry. This gaming industry is really young, and especially with this MMO thing, or with, you know, this immersive idea of gaming, because it's so young. You really haven't had the companies that have started at zero with everything. That's what we're doing.
Now, when are we looking at here as far as a launch date?
Oh, you know, it's hard for me to. We have talked about 2010, 2009, but as I've moved to see what this really entails to do it right. Now I'm talking about doing it right. Launch date will be when it is ready to go. The MMOs that have failed, and you know this, you know MMOs, the ones that have failed, and for that, not even just MMOs, but any video games, the ones that are most likely to fail are the ones that are really out there in beta form, but they're making people pay for it. This game will go out when it's ready. When this game's out there, you see this game on the market, it's because we know it's ready to go, and everything is in place, and not a day before that.
And my co-host Sam, you know her from Mysterious Galaxy, I can feel her tingling right now, because she's a huge gamer. You're driving her crazy with all this.
You got to be ready. It has to be so polished when it goes out the door. None of these 8-meg patches the week after launch. No, 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 no. We are going to playtest this thing to death. It is going to be ready to go when it comes out.
Now, this is for our future here, but are there other properties you guys want to develop?
Oh, we're an entertainment company, so absolutely. Right now, focus, but absolutely.
So you're going to get this question 1,000 times while you're here, so I'll be the first one, okay? Will there be anything based on your work or based on Todd's?
I would say I'm hoping that we'll be doing some things based on my work in the future. I would love that. It's less work for me if I already did it, right? No, I'm only kidding.
Here's the book, make it.
I would love, you know, if we do this right, then we'll be able to do a lot of things. And I would love, but that's in the future.
Can't let you leave without asking you, when's the next book? What are you writing right now? What's going on with your novels?
Yeah, I just finished The Ancient, which is a sequel to The Highwayman in my Demon Wars world of Corona. That'll be out with Tor Books early spring, I think, of next year. Yeah, great cover. Yeah. Todd Lockwood. I love Todd. And The Orc King. I'm back to Dritz. After a 2-year layoff doing the bad guys, I'm back to Dritz and King O'Bul, Many Arrows from the Two Swords. The Orc King comes out. It's one of the more dramatic books in the realms, I think, in terms of things are changing a little bit. I can't say any more than that, or WotC will hunt me down and kill me. But it is...
And that's October, right?
That is actually late September. September 25th, I think, is the release date. I'll be on tour. I think they're giving out postcards here about the tour dates. I'll be doing a couple of weeks West Coast and Midwest and through the Ohio Valley, I think. We've got the Orc King, then the Ancient, and then another Dritz book next fall of them that I'm about to start writing.
So you're back on the two a year for a couple of years yet?
For the next 3 years, two a year. And it's amazing because I think this whole thing with the video games has just given me the shot in the arm. I feel like I'm 30 again, and I haven't been this hopped up to work in years.
You know, I'm almost 30, and I don't feel hopped up to work, so that's good, I guess.
I'm almost 50, so when I feel hopped up to work, I go with it, man.
Well, Bob,
what I really want to do is retire and get on the beach. But
writers never really retire, right?
Yeah, that's the curse. I can't even go to bed at night without working. It's a curse.
I know you have a busy day, so I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much.
It was great seeing you again.
Hi, this is T. Morris of PatioBooks.com, Billabub Battings and the Case of the Singing Sword, and Moravi, the Chronicles of Rafe and Ascana. And you're listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. And don't let anybody tell you different. Science fiction publishing is an adventure.
Now I am joined by Brett Close, President and CEO. Can you start off by telling us how you got involved with 38 Studios?
Sure. As you probably know, 38 Studios is founded by Kurt Schilling, and he pulled together Todd McFarlane and R.A. Salvatore. And those guys are amazing visionaries, all of them. And Kurt recognized that if they were going to pull off the broad vision and the ambition that 38 Studios has in mind, that they needed to get game development experience involved. I've been a game developer for 15-plus years in a broad spectrum of roles in the industry. In the past, you know, 5-plus years in high-level leadership roles at various studios. And Kurt asked around in the industry, had some connections because of previous work that he'd done with Sony Online and some other things. And I guess my name popped up a couple of times, and he had a short list of people and called a couple of those and called me, and he and I immediately vibed about our alignment of philosophies about how products need to change in this industry and what can be done that's not currently being done, and more importantly, how you can do that with amazing talent and retain that talent and do it in a, of course, ethical, fun, great way to generate fantastic product. And, you know, when you get great talent and they're treated well and you give them a lot of license to create fantastic content, you know, great talent attracts more great talent, right? And so we talked a lot about that on the phone and then met, had a great big breakfast with he and Bob and I and went out to Tempe and visited Todd's studio and really just kind of did that initial vibe and got the organic thing going of this is what we all want to do, and it really just vibed out nicely of aligned visions. And so, you know, then Kurt said, you got to come out and do this. And I was actually in a really great position before, but this was something I simply could not pass up.
Now, when you talk about products needing to change and how things need to change, can you explain that a little bit, what you mean by that?
I can. There are a couple of major components to that. Talking about the product and then talking about the studio and the team. The vision of the product is, of course, with Todd and R.A. involved, is something unlike anything that's ever been done before, just in terms of what these guys contribute and their background in their industries that you could bring to video games. And you see a lot of other studios trying to do this, but they don't have the horsepower that we have, quite frankly. So then you couple that with a very deeply skilled veteran team of developers, of game developers, who've done it before, both on a significant range of massive multiplayer online products as well as console products in various other areas of the industry. And you look at what's going on out there with products that are interesting games, I would say, but not as compelling as they could and should be in terms of entertainment products, immersive entertainment products that engage you with a story, the likes of which somebody like Bob Salvatore can throw at you and just keep your mind spinning. There aren't products out there that do that yet, and we know exactly how we want to approach that. So without giving you details on the IP, because as I like to say, we're not going to uncork the bottle before it's time, I can tell you that with that talent coupling that we have. We're looking at what's currently out there, what they're not doing, and looking at our secret sauce and how we can apply that. And we absolutely already have a very clear idea of how we can impact the industry in a way that nobody has before.
Excellent. Of all the venues, why Comic-Con? Why did you guys decide to unveil everything this weekend?
Sure. Well, obviously, our association with Todd McFarlane is huge, and Bob, as I've already asserted, we are an entertainment company. 38 Studios will deliver a broad spectrum of content across multiple dimensions of media. So whether or not it's the MMO product that will be online in various forms, PC, console, web, engaging presence, graphical novels, video on demand, wireless, there are areas that we already know that we can go with our partnerships, and again with the association with Todd and NRA, that nobody else, frankly, has the sort of capability to penetrate the market. Between Todd, Kurt, and RA, we already have an audience that's 300 million plus. So that's a huge thing in developing your own intellectual IP. We are establishing, our own intellectual property. We are establishing a unique intellectual property, that, you know, we're not licensing somebody else's stuff. So we have a lot of license of what we want to generate and how we're going to focus that in a way that nobody has before. So, again, it aligns well with what Todd has done, who is obviously hugely associated with Comic-Con, and it's a great place for us to dip our toe in the water and start to tell people, we're coming. We're not going to tell you exactly what we're doing yet in terms of the intellectual property and how the MMO is going to work, but we are going to tell you what capabilities and what our potentials are and what you have to look forward to.
One of the things Bob was talking to us about is the desire to branch out into other mediums and releasing things simultaneously. What's your vision for that?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the ability for us both on a technological level with how the industry is changing, with how broadband is changing, with how wireless is changing, with the capability to do casual games, casual entertainment products, with the capability, whether or not it's web-based or hard copy graphical novels, as well as, again, delivering an episodic content MMO product, that creates so many opportunities that are not being capitalized and are not being exploited right now in terms of generating compelling entertainment content that people are just not getting yet. And again, back to the unique intellectual property piece, the industry right now is mired in sequels. People are starting to notice, fortunately, which I love seeing that because we're ahead of the curve. We recognized that long ago and recognized that we are going to be those guys that are out in front of it generating new IP that nobody's seen before and are going to get attached to. They've got some, you know, if you're a Todd McFarlane fan or an R.A. Salvatore fan, you're going to look at this and go, I love their stuff, and now it's going to go into an online product, online entertainment product. I just got to get my hands on it because I know what their track record is, and it's going to be great. So there are so many different places that we can go and so many different ways we can position that. It's pretty much unlimited.
Why do you think that more people in the industry haven't seen what you guys have seen? Is it just you get caught in doing things in the same cycle and get comfortable, or is there, have people tried in the past and not had success with it?
Well, I'm not going to make an embarrassing statement like we're geniuses and nobody else is, but I will say that there are other companies that have tried, and you look at some of the big publishers that are putting a lot of money behind Spielberg, Peter Jackson, various other big names associated with content and IP, and trying to do the same thing. The difference is they are mired with market constraints and bottom line constraints that we're not. We are, because of our private funding, because of the freedom that, frankly, Kurt and our partnerships allow us, we're in a position to have a much broader license, a much broader scope of power over what we generate and how we're going to put it out there than having to be a publisher whose accounting department is saying, no, we got to look at this formula that looks at the bottom line and takes this sequel, and you'll make X amount of money, and hopefully it'll be easier because that sequel's out there, which I'm not going to say from a bookkeeping bean counterpoint isn't a viable argument, but what it will do is continue to converge down that path of sequels, which are essentially a market that is a subset of a subset of a subset of a market, right? As opposed to being bold enough to run out there and generate a new IP. And so it's not that nobody else is trying to do it. We're just doing it in a way that is forming the partnerships and pulling the right team together, and we have the freedom, have created the freedom to give the people what they want.
It's amazing what happens when you don't hold people back.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Was there anything else you want to let us know about the studio?
38 Studios is a fantastic place to work. I know you probably hear that about a lot of places, but that's another core aspect of our vision is we're looking at not only new ways to deliver the MMO product and our entertainment products and new ways to design them, but we're looking at the best ways possible and new ways in the industry to allow people the freedoms, as you said, to unshackle that talent and let them run. And so it's the kind of place where people who are already there and new people who've started just look at this and say, this is the greatest place I've ever worked at. I cannot believe it. This is incredible. And as I say, that will only continue to attract more talent and will only give us that that energy to create content and entertainment that has never been seen before.
Well, thank you for your time. I hope we can do this again later down the road, get some updates for what's going on.
Thank you, Sean.
As day 4 in the Seventh Son adventure begins, John Alpha's quest for anarchy and genocide enters its final stage. At every turn, the global terrorist has been triumphant. The world is reeling from a nuclear attack. An unprecedented energy crisis is upon us. Alpha himself has exclusive access to the White House and secret weapons primed to propel his conspiracy into the end game. Amidst this turmoil, the Seventh Son Project's 4 surviving beta clones must defy their creators and hunt Alpha on their terms. Their mission? To stop the greatest assassination plot in history. The secrets John and his brothers discover will press them toward a final battle with their progenitor. A battle in which the clones are outgunned, outnumbered, and out of time. Seventh Son, Book 3, Destruction, is the final chapter in J.C. Hutchins' chart-topping audiobook thriller trilogy. Find the entire series, including Book 1, Descent, and Book 2, Deceit, at jchutchins.net and at audiobooks.com.
All right, more from our Comic-Con extravaganza. And I'm now joined by Nightshade Books' Jeremy Lassen. Jeremy, what is your official title at Nightshade, by the way?
At Nightshade, I am the editor-in-chief. I'm also one of the co-owners of the company, but official title is editor-in-chief.
Can you just start us off by telling us how Nightshade got started and what you guys are all about?
Yeah, we published our first book almost 10 years ago now. It was founded... No. Long Strange Trip. The original founder, Jason Williams, was working in Silicon Valley and was a big Lovecraft fan and discovered this book, The Necronomicon Files, that the authors were trying to publish. And he said, well, you should self-publish it. If nobody wants to publish it, you should self-publish it. And they were like, we don't have the money for that. And Jason said, well, I'll fund it because I want to read a copy. And they took that to mean that Jason would be their publisher. So he kind of backed into becoming a publisher. Huh. And at the same time, I had been working at various indie bookstores for science fiction bookstores for a while, and I decided that publishing an anthology was a really good idea. And so I started working on my own project, and we both met in San Francisco at Borderlands Books and kind of ended up teaming up forces and merging the companies, merging the projects, and been going strong ever since.
So is your first project then an actual anthology?
Yeah, my first project was an anthology of short horror fiction set in Southern California called Aftershocks. And it was filled with a lot of the authors that I had met when I was working at Mysterious Galaxy. And because every first-time publisher thinks that the best thing, that the most commercial project that the marketplace is just waiting for is a collection of horror fiction. Original horror fiction, wow.
Oh, yeah, that sells so well.
It does. But it was also one of those times when, you know, the horror industry was really in a slump. Nobody was publishing horror. Nobody was calling it horror. And, you know, working in bookstores, you know, it became an idea, you know, rather than complain about it, I decided to put my money where my mouth was and say, you know what, I'm going to do it. And I'd seen a lot of other indie publishers, you know, Cemetery Dance, Subterranean, who were doing stuff in the horror field and doing exciting stuff. And I was like, well, I can do that. And my publishing experience grew out of, I was doing a zine at the time. And, you know, just kind of a poetry and fiction magazine and, you know, photocopied, you know, kind of zine thing. And I got some magazine distribution contract proposals. And it looked like the best way to lose a lot of money would be to try and get your zine distributed through these various newsstands. It was just awful. And I was like, well, I'll lose far less money publishing a book. And so that kind of led to that anthology.
Well, okay, let me get your opinion on this. Because you're saying how the horror genre is down a little bit. You know, markets, they kind of rise and fall. But as an editor, do you think there's always room for a good book? It doesn't matter what the market says. If it's oversaturated or undersaturated, there's always room for a good book. Is there a problem getting those good books sometimes?
No, I totally agree with you. If it's a good book, it doesn't matter if the industry, you know, that particular subgenre is in a slump or if it's oversaturated. Good writing wins out over everything. I mean, my example for that, like really good, compelling writing. I read a lot of my submissions on my phone. Like I read it, you know, as a manuscript on my phone, like when I'm on the bus, on the subway, because that's the best way to decide whether the book is really grabbing you or not. I mean, there's been manuscripts where I've missed my stop because I'm like reading and I end up like five stops down the line because I totally lost track of where I was when I'm on a subway with a bunch of people around me. And if a book is that good that it takes me away, yeah, it doesn't matter what the genre is, what the category is. Good writing, compelling writing like that, that wins out all the time.
Do you think that the small screen helps too? Because you have to be locked in, and if you're not locked in, you can't like flip the next page and see what's there.
No, I mean, the ebook thing is just a matter of habit. It's far easier for me because I have so many manuscripts and unbound manuscripts. Once you get used to reading in a certain format, it doesn't become much of an issue for me. I mean, I totally prefer books as a reading experience, but the convenience factor of being able to, you know, bring five manuscripts, because it doesn't do any good to bring just the first chapter. Because if it's a good first chapter, I want to read the second chapter and the third chapter, but a lot of manuscripts, I don't get past the first chapter. So to be able to put like 5, 6, 10 complete manuscripts on my phone and just like, oh, click, okay, not that one, click, okay, not that one, but then find that one, you know, three down the stack that just totally grabs me. Makes me get through the slush pile a lot quicker.
Well, we were talking a little bit about this before we hit the record button, but can you tell us how your experience as a bookseller has informed your style as an editor and how you approach the business?
Well, actually, I being an independent publisher where I have control over the entire process, I have control over what the cover art's going to be, how it's going to be marketed, what those, you know, across the whole board. And so that definitely helps a lot. And definitely seeing those buying patterns, like you say, if it's face out or not. When we first founded the company, as a retailer and as, you know, an avid book fan, I knew the importance of having a good cover. You know, a lot of indie publishers, you know, their books look small press. They look, right, you know, kind of, they don't look like the other books on the shelf. And that was one area where, as a small publisher with not a lot of capital, I could compete and make my books look just as good or better than the New York publishers and, you know, have them win that battle on the shelf. Because every sale is a series of small battles, and you got to win every one of them. How do you get them to pick up your book off the shelf and somebody else's? So either the cover or the spine's got to be compelling. And then once they pick it up, they got to glance at the front cover and be able to instantly code it. Is it fantasy? Is it science fiction? Is it military SF? Is it paranormal romance? Is it, you know, what kind of subcategory is it? So you have to be able to, you know, just at a glance, code the cover properly so that the right person then flips the cover over and looks at the back. And then flips and looks at the front flap of the hardcover or the splash page, or then goes to the first chapter. Every one of those steps is a battle, and you have to win every one of them in order to get them to buy the book.
Right.
go up to the counter and put down their money. And so that kind of like visceral knowledge of like the steps of book selling really kind of helps keep you focused, because it can become very abstract when you're like reading manuscripts and when you're laying out books and when you're doing any of the hundreds of little jobs. Being able to like go back to that, no, this is going to be an artifact, or it's going to be a listing on Amazon, it's got to win in those, in that context. And so being closely connected to that, you know, definitely helps.
Are you a believer in the power of praise quotes from other authors?
Because
I've heard some conflicting things from different people.
Well, from a reader's perspective, there's people who ignore them and there's people who totally pay attention to them. As a bookseller, I see both. I myself don't base what I'm reading on those blurbs at all. But I know I've run into a lot of people who do. And by the same token, that's one way to get the buyers at various large bookstores to notice your books, because they need something to differentiate this category fantasy book from this other category fantasy book. And if it's a blurb by a very high profile author versus a blurb by a not very high profile author, these are the ways in which buying decisions are made, because they see thousands and thousands of books, you know, practically a month, and they can't read all of them, and there's arbitrary guidelines that kind of separate things out, and the blurbs and the category of the blurbs and who's doing the blurbs go a long way towards doing that. The other thing that the blurbs do is, that actually is really important, is it helps make those subcategories. It helps make it clear. When that reader glances at the front cover and they see a blurb by David Drake, well, they know that this book is probably going to be military SF. Whereas if they see a blurb by Robin Hobb, they probably know it's going to be fantasy. And so it helps further code the book. So I don't think that they're good in the, well, this is definitely going to sell or not sell, but they're very useful in the kind of coding of the book to the buyers at the chains and to the retail customers in the stores.
And you talk about all those series of battles you have to win, and winning the battle of the buyers at BN and Borders, that's a huge one, right? Because, I mean, I've heard some really interesting stories about how you have just a handful of people really determining which science fiction and fantasy books get into the big chains.
Well, that's absolutely true. You know, there's one science fiction buyer for Barnes & Noble, and there's one science fiction buyer for Borders, and they have a huge part of the marketplace. But it does cut both ways. That can be a choke point, or, you know, I'm a very small company, and my books are routinely on the front counters at Borders and Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
So that means that I have access to a very large part of the retail marketplace. So it does cut both ways. It's both good and bad. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I came up as an independent bookseller, and I have kind of a, you know, frustrating... It's been very frustrating to see independent bookstores on the decline over the last 15 years. But at the same time, in a lot of parts of the country, you know, those chains are the only places to get books. And so I heartily support independence, but at the same time, I'm not going to rail against the chains, because frankly, they've both been very good to me. And the other thing is to keep in mind is those two guys, or anybody in science fiction and fantasy as a pro working in these big conglomerates, they're there because they love it. They're there because they're fans. You know, they're not some faceless cogs who have no connection to the material. You know, that was one thing that was made very clear to me. Like, the first time that I met the buyers was like, hey, these are guys just like me who really love this material. They may have different tastes, and you can kind of see it, the difference in taste between, you know, one chain buyer and the other chain buyer, just by the selection or by the quantities that they buy or the front table placement. But they're both fans, and they both love the material. And, you know, they love it just as much as the independent booksellers who are out there, you know, every day selling the stuff that they love. They just happen to have a lot more power.
Well, what do you guys specialize in? What's Nightshade's specialty?
We do exclusively category genre fiction, science fiction, fantasy, and horror. We've been doing a lot more science fiction and fantasy lately. When we first started out, we were doing a lot of what we affectionately refer to as dead guys. We're doing classic reprints. We've done like a five-volume set of Manly Wade Wellman's Weird Fiction. We did a five-volume set of The Complete Fiction of William Hope Hodgson. We published some Lovecraft, like Lovecraft Letters and Lovecraft Poetry. So a lot of the kind of classic weird fiction, we've we kind of started there. And it's really funny. So when we first started publishing, like, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, we were trying to get access to a contemporary fiction, new novels, new short story collections, and we were publishing that. But because we were much smaller, we didn't have the presence, we didn't basically know what we were doing, none of the new stuff that we were doing was selling very well. It was all losing money, losing a lot of money. But the only thing that was selling was, like, one of the first things that was a big success was Manly Wade Wellman. And this was a guy who, at the time, had been completely out of print, enormously influential. He was a weird fiction. He wrote for Weird Tales back. He was a contemporary Ray Bradbury in the 40s and 50s, and just very prolific, very influential. I mean, I read a lot of his short fiction growing up, and, you know, then Jason and I got talking about this project, and we're like, yes, we should definitely do this, because in the used market, the only copies available were, like, super high price, like $250 copies of an ex-library book was the only way that you could get, like, any of his short fiction.
It's been read 5,000 times and passed around.
It's not even, like, a really nice collectible. It's like a beat-to-crap ex-library edition that's going for $250 just because there wasn't any copies out there. And so we thought, well, let's do some, like, high-priced hardcovers, $35 hardcovers, no jacket. We'll probably just sell them to the libraries, but we want to keep his fiction out there, and so we're doing it for the love. And we didn't expect to make money on that, but at the time, it totally flipped. And the Wellman stuff found an audience. I mean, the weird fiction community rallied behind us, very much supported it, and, you know, a lot of the genre community kind of came back to Wellman and kind of rediscovered him. And so that 5-volume set was one of our first commercial successes, and it really kind of put the punctuation mark on the fact that there are vast segments of the publishing industry that aren't, you know, of the publishing marketplace that aren't being served. You know, classic weird fiction, Manly Wade Wellman 10 years ago was not in print at all, and we were able to hit that. And as a publisher, being able to hit that portion of the marketplace that is being underserved and being able to hit it efficiently is kind of like the key that we learned early on. So we did some other weird fiction. The William Hope Hodgson stuff was another example. Like, both my business partner Jason and I, huge William Hope Hodgson fans. We spent, like, years and thousands of dollars putting together a collection of other William Hope Hodgson, all of his short fiction, and it was still less than half of, like, his total fiction output. A lot of stuff had never been reprinted from the turn-of-the-century magazines it was really originally published in, or the original books it was published in. You just couldn't get it. And so...
So when you're getting the rights for something like that, is it the family that has the rights, or was any of it owned by a publisher still?
Oh, that was... It's on an individual basis. Like, the Manly Wade Wellman stuff was owned by Manly. Manly's wife was still alive. At the time that we bought it. And then, sadly, right after we put out the first book, she died, and the estate was sold to one of his friends, David Drake, actually. So working with the estates is one thing. William Hope Hodgson's stuff was, with the exception of, like, two stories, was all out of copyright. And okay. So it was a matter of just getting good texts and making those available. William Hope Hodgson was essentially a public domain author. But then working with, like, we published some Carl Edward Wagner, his Kane fiction, his novels and short stories, and so working with Carl's estate, it can be a lot of work to either track down the right people, the right estate, or, I mean, actually the real problem is, the real expense is getting electronic copy of a lot of these stories. The only extant copy is a bad photocopy of, you know, a magazine that was published in 1906, you pretty much have to transcribe that. You have to either type it in yourself or pay somebody to type it in. And then you have to get it proofed against that source, or, you know, and then you have to... So just the preparation of electronic texts can be very time-consuming. Even scanning in old paperbacks, it's really funny how much I take it for granted working with a lot of you know, younger authors whose work is all available electronically. It's like, oh, send me that manuscript. But then you work with somebody like David Drake, who's been writing since the early 70s, and we just published a collection of his fiction that covers a lot of that time period from some of his early publication credits, and he didn't have any electronic copies of it. So it was tracking down anthologies and magazines and scanning them in and getting them, you know, then copy edited and proofed and cleaned up is a much more daunting task than actually tracking down these estates.
But you guys now have moved to, you know, not original novels, big names in the field. So can you tell us about that transition, how that worked out for you?
Well, I've always been very optimistic. I mean, working in independent bookstores, I've been seeing the kind of the conglomeratization of a big publishing. You know, the big six, the big seven, or now the big five, the big four. You know, there's a lot of imprints, but they're all owned by the same mega publishing companies. And
they're all overseas now, too, right?
Several of them. You know, several of them are French or German owned, which isn't, I mean, isn't a bad thing at all. It's funny, the conglomerates that, to get off topic a little bit, in my opinion, the conglomerates that specialize in book publishing do a much better job than the synergistic media companies. Like, for example, Time Warner. You know, Warner Films, they had a publishing division, Warner Books. Well, they just sold that off to a French company that specializes in just books. Because if you specialize in just books, you know what the market is, you know what an expected rate of growth is, you have proper expectations. Whereas media companies, you know, they sell DVDs, they sell movies, they sell CDs, and then they see books, which are a much, much smaller segment of the marketplace. And so they tend to start marginalizing things, only going for, you know, the brand name co-op stuff. And so the people who specialize in the big companies that like Bertelsmann, VHPS, you know, Hachette, I think they do a better job than the, you know, the Time Warners and the HarperCollins, you know, the Simon Schusters and stuff like that. But how I got my access to the marketplace is all of these big conglomerates have enormous amounts of overhead. And so they have to focus on books that are going to have a theoretical, you know, sell-through of 10, 20, 30, 50,000 copies. Whereas if I sell 5,000 copies of a book, I'm making a lot of money off of it. I'm doing pretty good. Not a lot of money, but, you know, I'm doing okay. You know, I'm going out to dinner that night. So, and it's perfectly viable to publish a book that is, quote-unquote, only going to sell 5,000 copies. There's a perfectly viable business model there. And so there's a lot of mid-list authors that are totally marginalized, that aren't getting any kind of support or getting dropped completely. We've had a lot of success with, say, Liz Williams, who she wasn't able to take off at Bantam. And we picked her up and started a new series with her, and we've been building her and done very well with her. But that kind of, like, long-term commitment to three books in the series when the first one was a slow grow just wasn't something that, you know, a larger publisher could do. Now, and once again, you know, there are plenty of editors who, you know, will take a bullet for an author and try and do that. But again, they're working outside of the business model of that major publishing company, which is to sell, you know, 50, 100,000 units of something. Whereas, like I say, I can make money, I can go forward, and I can grow doing these mid-list projects. For example, one of the first big novels that we got was by Ian Banks, The Algebraist. He had been kind of unhappy with how Simon & Schuster had been treating him, and his agent was like, you know what? You guys should make a bid. Because we'd worked with that agent before. We'd done a book by one of Banks' friends, M. John Harrison. We did a collection with him, did really well with it, unexpectedly well with it, got a lot of press, sold out the print run, And so the agent and Banks are really, you know, kind of like, wow, these guys might know what they're doing. Maybe we should give it to them. They can't do any worse than, you know. And it was kind of the attitude that, actually, it was really funny. Like, Banks had an online interview that I set up for him at Salon.com. And so they finally got around to talking about the book, which took a while. But they got down to talking about the book, and they was like, so why did you sell it to these Nightshade guys? And Banks' response was, well, I've been pretty much published by everybody in the States, and nobody's really done a very good job of it, so I figure they can't do any worse than anybody else has. And I was like, there's confidence, thanks.
Yeah, really.
But no, I mean, and we've done extraordinarily well with it.
Wasn't that on the Hugo ballot?
It was on the Hugo ballot, but it made the Hugo ballot before we put our edition out.
Okay.
We had it under contract before it got made the ballot, but it came out like the month of the Worldcon that year. But we sold through a hardcover run. It was actually the Amazon.com number one science fiction book of the year. Editor's pick number one science fiction book of the year. Got a lot of coverage for it. And then put it out in trade paperback and have been selling the hell out of it. So we exceeded his last couple of publishers, sales figures quite handily. So, and I don't think any of it was necessarily intrinsically what we did, but we were willing to treat it like a big book. And it was. When we published it, it was the biggest book on our list. It was the most important book on our list. And we treated it accordingly. Because, so much of all publishing is perception. And if you put an Ian Banks book out and, kind of a mid-list in the bottom of your catalog and you're not very excited about it, the sales force doesn't, do a hard sell on it to the buyers at the chains and stuff like that, then it becomes a small book. It may be the same book, but if I put it out and I'm, running around enthusiastically telling everybody about it and giving away galleys and, out there beating the bush, suddenly people are willing to, well, I should review that. I should cover that. I should put it on the front table and, that type of thing. And that's actually one of the insights that I've gotten from talking to and learning about the structure of kind of mainstream New York publishing is that the editors, one of the biggest jobs that, from my perspective, the editors do is get the internal sales force behind their book instead of somebody else's book. So there's a finite amount of sales and marketing resources. And all the editors are basically trying to get as much share of that sales and marketing resource as possible for their book at the expense of other books on their on the publisher's list. And with Nightshade, I have the benefit of I don't have internal competition for the books. The big books that are going to benefit from it get it. I've got a new Walter John Williams novel coming out next year. It's a post-singularity novel. It's cool as hell, and I'm the biggest Walter John Williams fan in the universe. One of the reasons I got together with my business partners, because the first day we met, we sat around and bonded over, damn, wasn't Hardwired great, Voice of the Whirlwind, talking about all Days of Atonement, was that totally weird New Mexico time travel novel that nobody ever read except you and me, and we love it, yes. And, so for us, Walter's a huge deal. We love Walter John Williams, and to be able to be publishing his new novel is big. And so we're treating it accordingly.
We'll have to get him on the show to talk about it when it's coming out.
Yeah, I'll definitely put him in contact with you because, he's a great guy. But he had a paperback series come out from HarperCollins. It was a space opera. It was really good. It's called The Dread Empire.
Dread Empire Falls in...
Yeah, The Praxis, The Sundering, and it sold pretty well, but it didn't sell well enough for HarperCollins, because HarperCollins, they publish Neal Stephenson, they publish Neil Gaiman, they have very, very high expectations for their sales, particularly for their mass market books that they do, and when they don't meet those sales thresholds, it may be a book that's building, it may be a book that's, increasing its audience, but by the time that third book is solicited, they know whether or not there's going to be a fourth book. And so they pretty much said, okay, well, and they wrapped that series up, and then there wasn't any interest in working with them again, either on subsequent books in the series or on another book, just because the sales threshold wasn't there. Whereas getting stuck behind those oftentimes arbitrary sales thresholds is not a problem that I have. I publish books that I know I'm only going to sell 1,000 copies of. But I can do that because I control costs and I manage what the project can support, and I have very low overhead, so I can set aside one of my slots for a book that I love, even though it's, not going to be loved by more than 1,000 people.
I think it's your suit and your hats.
It's my suit and hats.
I see you walking around. I want to buy all your books, and I see you walking around in that.
Yeah, well, that kind of cult of personality, branding that I do with Nightshade is... It's part and parcel of trying to keep a small business afloat.
Yeah.
I like to say that I'm the Steve Jobs of publishing. Because, Mac fans, people who are I love Macintosh, are crazy supportive of Macintosh. Even when they make missteps or even when, they're always but no, all on the whole, Mac is a good company. They do good things. I like them. And you watch those keynote addresses where Steve Jobs is up there. He's like a revival preacher, and let me tell you about the iPhone. It's going to do everything for you. And I want to do that for books. So, I get the Zoot suit. I get the hat. I get the, electric blue suits. And I roam the conventions. And I I say, I got books for you. You're going to like this book. Because it's a good way to convey that enthusiasm. I mean, I'm lucky enough to be able to be comfortable doing something like that. I mean, it was really funny. I've been doing conventions for you know, quite a long time, 10 years now. You know, science fiction, fantasy, horror conventions. And I've always been, like, jeans and a t-shirt guy. And then, like, a couple years ago, I was doing Book Expo, and that's a big general interest trade show. So it wasn't my group of people where I was comfortable with, and I was trying to present the company as, here we are, we're a pro company, we're a big company. I couldn't wear jeans and a t-shirt. You know, I was starting to have meetings with, you know, buyers in New York and stuff like that, agents, and it was like, okay, jeans and a t-shirt, I want to present a little more professional of an image. But then I got to let my own self get carried away with that, and I thought, well, if I'm going to have adult clothes, I'm going to have fun adult clothes. And so I'm like, I should get a zoot suit. Hell yeah, let me get a zoot suit with a 2-foot-long red feather in my hat, and, you know, let me get that electric blue suit like the demon from Buffy the Vampire Slayer the musical was wearing. Like, yes, I could wear that suit right there. Actually, the electric blue suit was like the last suit that I bought, and I was sitting around with my wife. We were watching Buffy the Musical, and like the soft shoe demon comes on, and he's like, da 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 da. And I'm like looking at him, and I'm like, that suit right there. They've got that suit at my place in San Francisco. They've got that at Siegel's. I could wear that suit. My wife is sitting there going, oh, God. You're going to get an electric blue suit. And I was like, yes, an electric blue suit. That would be awesome. And so, yeah, it's just a way to kind of stand out.
Well, it works.
Does it work?
Yeah, okay. It does. Last question for you.
Okay.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's coming out over the next year?
Yeah. Well, I already touched on Walter John Williams. He's got a post-singularity novel called Implied Spaces. And anybody who loves Charlie Strauss or Werner Vange or any of the kind of singularity literature, man, this one's going to be great. And it's got Walter's kind of signature brilliance. We've got a new Greg Egan novel coming out. He hasn't written a novel in a long time, and that one's coming out next spring as well. We actually just had Richard Kadrey. He was one of the original cyberpunk writers back in the 80s, and he hasn't been writing for a while, but we've got his new novel coming out. Actually, just came out this month. He's here at the show. It's called Butcher Bird, and it's sort of a Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets Milton, Paradise Lost, with a lot of kind of San Francisco street counterculture stuff thrown in. Those are three that I'm really excited about. Oh, and for those really small books that there's a small audience for, it's an important book. Laird Barron is a horror short fiction writer. He's kind of like a Thomas Ligotti or H.P. Lovecraft. He's really one of the most exciting short horror fiction writers around, and we just put out his first collection, The Imago Sequence and Others. Keep an eye out for that one. I think every time he writes a story, he gets nominated or wins an award, and we're excited about that one. On the other one, along those lines also, in the science fiction field, Paolo Bajagalupi, we've got a collection called Pump Six, which is coming out in January. And so those are kind of our two dark horse, like, you know, not very commercial, but damn, they're good, and, you know, those are the books why I got in this industry.
Cool. And of course, you can find all that at nightshadebooks.com, right?
Nightshadebooks.com, yep. Or your local independent bookstore, wherever you choose to find books. We've got them available.
Well, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Music for Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing by Cargo Cult. From their song, Dirt. You can learn more about them at magnatune.com. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production. To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.